This is Louise Bode, February 18th, 1991, a talk entitled Anima.
Many of you, I think, were probably here before, and I just wanted to mention that there will be three talks in March. On March 11th, I'm going to talk about Jungian and Freudian dream theory. And the Monday after that, on the 18th, I'm going to repeat the first lecture in the series because there were a lot of people that weren't able to come that night. And I'm going to talk about Jung's theory of complexes. And then the final talk in the series will be on March 25th, which will be about individuation and the self. So I think I won't say more now, but I will let Louise continue with her discussion of the anima and animus. This is Louise Bode. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, as I told someone, you're brave souls to come out. It's a holiday and it's raining. What I wanted to do tonight is really just three things. You know, there's so much material that we're trying to get a grasp of, and we could have spent five evenings just on one of these. And so if we could really just get a very good working definition of the animus and the anima, that's the first thing I would like to do. Then to pick up and explore more of the syzygy that we were talking about. The syzygy being the relationship between the anima and the animus. And then the third thing, according to how much time we have, to see what, well, so what? What does all of this have meaning for us in our relationships, possibly in therapy, but I'm not going to major on that. And in individuation, which is that journey toward wholeness, knowing all of the aspects of ourself. So to begin with, for some definitions, to remind us again that when Jung was talking about the anima and the animus, he was talking about a bundle of characteristics, a cluster of functions. At least this is how his work started out when he began to develop all of his theory on the anima and the animus. And it came right out of his own personal experience as he was coming out of those deep experiences of the unconscious in those years after he had broken with Freud. Some of this is in his work on the Seven Sermons to the Dead. And then it's very interesting, a number of analysts have traced his development of the anima. That's what he started with because that is the, quote, feminine or the contrasexual within himself. And then he kind of added on and developed some of the animus. But this cluster of characteristics, or this cluster of functionings that culture had put a label on. These are feminine characteristics. These are masculine qualities. And in the years since Jung first begun this, as we said last week, these words have become frozen, and it's like the animus is this, 1, 2, 3, and this is a picture of your psyche, and women have an animus, and men don't. And, of course, we talked about that quandary last week. And the syzygy is saying that both men and women each have an anima and an animus. But what are these clusters that Jung talked about? Now, I put a list on the board, and this is only a partial list. And I want this first half hour of ours together, or maybe we want to take as long as it takes, to pull what you think the animus is and what you can add. But let's begin with this list. And this... Let's start over here, because we're describing a kind of functions and qualities that are opposite than these. And there's a solar consciousness versus the lunar. Very simple. The sun is different than the moon, and the sun is very direct. And you can see every detail. And the moon, you don't see every detail. You see those broad, lovely outlines. So these kinds of energies, the mind, the body, consciousness, very different than just life in general. There's a kind of energy in consciousness that's different than life energy. If we're thinking now of consciousness as a faculty, as a function. Certainly these are self-explanatory, and analysis of the parts, or against a concern that takes in the whole works, the totality. There's the active, receptive. And these may seem strange opposites, but they really are power and love. It's not love and hate. That's two like qualities on the same continuum, the opposite of a quality. But think of power, then think of love. Very interestingly, someone says, why do we forget that there is power in love? Or that power itself can be used for love. But anyhow, these opposites. Then rational, irrational. And I don't like irrational. I put into it that suits me better. Focusing kind of energy, as differentiated from the diffuse energy that again encompasses that whole. Logos, eros, open spaces, very different than closed space. And then here, the mind-body, that combination, which is kind of very evident and very much in this world, as different from the subtle body. And I think this is what Jung was getting into in his Sermons of the Dead, when he was really talking about that which was created, and then what he called the pleroma, that which was uncreated and just frozen, and out of that came voices that spoke to them. So, mind and body, subtle body. We can keep on going with this. Heaven and earth, sacred and profane, very different. Separation, different than fusion. Light, dark. Finally, spirit, soul. They're different. And Jung associated these on the left side here with what? Okay, we got four terms out there. What do you think? What kind of consciousness is this? So that would make those animus qualities, right? If we're going to go with that. And these are feminine consciousness or manifestation of the feminine. We think of the material, the body is formed. And these would be those functions, those facilities that would be anima qualities. Now, that's kind of a beginning to get something down tighter than I like to get it, but I think we need to have something up here. Logos. Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you're familiar with that, it's one of the books of the New Testament where it starts off, it's that marvelous book where it says, quote it for me, in the beginning was the Word. That's Logos. We're talking on that level. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that most of you have your thoughts about what these are. And I think it would be very rich if you could share and all put into this time right now of what this working definition. We're trying to see what these energies are. They're very vital. They're functioning in us. What are they? Why do they attract us? What do they do? But what are your experiences, or what would you like to add in terms of defining? Or maybe how do these show up in a dream? What kind of images do they appear in? The rain got you. Ah, okay. I think I'll just put them on the blackboard.
Okay. Somehow my magic marker is not. And doing is the magic thing. Being. What else?
There were some other hands went up about the same time. In a dream, in different relationship to each other. One was advising the male, and then a female figure was kind of just around. Were you able to relate to those images? May I just make a few comments? I don't want to get into your dream or begin to work with it. But when figures like this show up in a dream, and many of you know this, but again, we're reviewing and we're talking together to get a working definition of what these terms were. What would those male figures remind you of? Were they strangers? Were they images of someone you know? What are those qualities? It's there where the interaction is going on, isn't it? And if the masculine does represent the animus, then several facets of the animus were talking together, weren't they? And if you, as the ego, could find out what that was about, think of the richness that would be. And it's interesting that the feminine was in there, but she was in the background. That would kind of be this syzygy that we were talking about last week, that we really can't think of the animus without the anima, the masculine without the feminine. And in this case, she wasn't involved, she was just around. But it was the action between those two parts. Someone else have another image of animus? And maybe a man. Yes, Larry.
I just think of one as a judgmental perception. It's kind of like the only rational thing.
The animus often shows up judging, doesn't he? Both in a negative sense and in a positive sense. sense. Positive, and then he helps distinguish and discriminate. Negative, and particularly women with a negative animus, what would that mean in terms of what you know about what the animus is? And why is it negative? Well, you know, I think it was Dr. von Franz said that her animus wanted to be busy. And if she, meaning her ego consciousness, gave him work to do, he did it beautifully and he let her alone. But if she didn't, then was he ever after her? And you know she's an analyst of long years of experience with all this inner stuff. I think so often that's one reason that the animus is negative. He's so good and he has so much ability and he wants to be busy and he wants to differentiate. He wants to function. And when he's not honored and given a piece of work, and I've particularly seen this in people who had a mind, and not just women. Notice I didn't say women. I said people. Who had a mind and those abilities and weren't using it. And the self-judgment that they lived in. The animus has to do something. And so he does. And when it doesn't have a chance to go out and be creative, it turns inward and is very destructive. Kate. Absolutely. He's chasing, and that's... And listen to the words that Kate has used. He can be damaging. You said he could be shooting. He could be... What else? Yeah, or often it appears with a knife, or a knife itself shows up in your dreams. Well, we said one of the functions was to discriminate, to cut through. Okay, so there it is. And if he can't, he's going to shoot, or he's going to knife, or he's going to do something to cut. Okay? There was another hand. Yes?
What do you mean by good job?
Has anybody given him something to do? Well, it's like Dr. von Franz. When she would go and sit at her typewriter and get at her work of writing, then he was busy. If she were to get overbalanced and do too much gardening, that might satisfy another aspect of herself, the earth man or some feminine part, but something that would give expression to these qualities. Are you tracking with me?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Okay, I've got to do this because I'm so interested in this thing of the relationship of the anima and animus. And if there's an animus or a male that is darn this thing. That is a workaholic. That means that one side is getting more attention, more expression. The side that's these functionings. Let me draw that syzygy up here. I'm going to put the male ego up here. And when I say that, you all know what I mean. I simply mean this conscious space, this ego space that we're coming out of, differentiated from the anima or animus functionings, or the unconscious. And down here, we have this
syzygy, the anima, and the animus. Now, if this side, those functions are what have taken over in the workaholic, regardless of whether it's a man or a woman, what does that tell us about what's going on in this relationship internally with the other side of that person? Well, there's no balance, is there? It's just like the outer partner that gets left at home by the workaholic. One whole part of one's aspect internally has gotten left. And later we're going to get into many reasons of why that might be. But there's so much, as we think about that, okay. Some analysts have called that the ego being identified with the animus, the ego animus, or the animus ego. They've only used that, most of them, in a woman, which again, short circuits here. Or the anima ego in a man, but I don't want to get into these labels too much. It would mean then that the ego simply is only in touch with this. Now, I know all of you can't see this. I'm going to draw it up a little higher. If we remember that the anima and animus is sort of that guide to the unconscious, and we talked last week, it's that which begins to lead us into the archetypal depths. So we have to know that a lot of this is very unconscious. Somewhere where these functions, these characteristics are conscious, these animus and anima qualities are available to us. The less that's available, the more unconscious, then the more of the workaholic, the more the judging, the more of some of these characters that you've been saying. So maybe that's... Go ahead. All right. Who could give an example of a man that we might say was anima possessed? I'm talking about animus a while, but either way. Dylan Thomas, who was the poet, and yet anima possessed possibly in terms of his alcoholism, his possession by the realm of the intuitive, the irrational, love, feelings, the following after the lure of that unconscious anima.
What's another example? All right. Yes. Now, both of these are writers that deal with very deep stuff. What about... All right. Well, now, see, here you've opened up another hole. That's why we need 2 months at this. If we're going to go along with what we're saying, if she were workaholic and judgmental and possessed by the characters of what we're calling animus characters, then she would be animus. But if, and you're right, if it were obsessed possibly by the irrational, the intuitive, then we would say, I think, that that side had taken over, that there wasn't enough structure, there wasn't enough animus direction to keep her related to everyday life, to get her off of that workaholic. There's a fine line between these, and it gets very hard, and that's what, because a workaholic, a woman could also be animus possessed. Driven is a word that you hear about both men and women. That part that's the non-feeling, the non-intuitive, but that's goal-oriented and driving towards it. What else about these two? Yes. Said deep stuff, I meant it's not up here in the ego consciousness, is it? There's a muse that they're listening to, and that's out of the depths. And that's not negative. But when, again, it possesses people, and the artist carries some of this, don't they? And are we to say that's negative? See, pretty soon we begin to see how relative all this is, and we can't label one thing something. Yeah, some people, and I have known them, don't want to go into analysis because they are afraid that they will lose their talent. Now, I'm not sure that's right. I don't think so, if it really works. But I don't want to get into that. We're going to talk a little bit about that in individuation. On the back row. Usually, there's a part of the anima that's very unconscious, down below anything that he knows about. I can give you an example of an analysis I work with, and this is not in Seattle, and I'm always careful to say that, and I never give examples unless I have had permission to do so. But a young man in his 40s, with many of the characteristics of what Dr. von Franz would describe as the eternal youth, and the dream that he had upon entering analysis was being in an outdoor situation and following a voice that he heard that took him off into the canyon. He could never catch up with her. He'd get to one corner and he'd think, ah, and he'd get there and then round the next corner, like the sirens that we read about in the poetry. That represented a very, very deep part of his anima that was beginning to come in to his consciousness, was calling to him to follow. Like Kate said, maybe wanted attention. But on the other hand, he never caught up with her. And he would just follow, 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 follow. Well, see, that's possession. Yes, and so, yes, and just as he couldn't catch up with that voice so that it might be embodied, see, it was a voice, it was not a woman, it was a voice. It was hard for him to make commitments in an outer relationship so that a relationship could be embodied. Now, does that get at it a bit? Okay.
He has Tinkerbell, and that's kind of his end. My idea of being possessed, which means he does what he does. She becomes a mother for the mother's children. He recruits her to do that. And he's motivated to do that by Tinkerbell.
That's interesting. But who would be his anima?
But if he was possessed, he would do the job. But he's loyal to his sex more than by fighting with.
I'm not sure that possession means doing the work of the anima.
That's what I interpret it as. In other words, he tries to actually do what the anima directs him to do, getting by possession or identifying with it.
Mm-hmm.
But in that cartoon, what he did is he included Wendy, who really wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the one that felt the most interested.
But see, but the very fact that he could recruit, that took a lot of outgoing, active. No.
But he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Tinkerbell wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a real subtle difference here in what possession means and actually doing the work of it. Somebody else was going to add here. Yes. You. Oh, my. Whatever it was that Henry Fonda represented, and it was a lot of energy, this fine horse, and we could get into all this, and this is not proper to do in public without permission. But whatever that was, you helped to pull it up, didn't you? At least there was some connection, and what had been so unconscious and sinking even deeper, you were in touch with, and those animus qualities. Well, maybe we should move on just a bit here. Complicate this working definition just a little bit more. How many of you were able to come to Kate's lecture and you know what the persona is, right? I don't want to. Okay. What's persona? We all got them. We all know what it is. What is it? It's that role that we assume and take, a mask, and we have to have them. You've all sat by people on a bus or a plane that didn't have any persona. And gosh, by the time you got to where you were going, you knew more about them than you ever wanted to know. There was no persona. They didn't hold anything within them. So persona is not all negative. It's okay. And a feminine persona, well, that's what women have, and much of it comes from society's definitions. And a male persona is what men have, also dictated by much of what society says and how we were raised, all of that input into us. Carolyn Stevens, an analyst in Chicago, in a paper at this conference that I mentioned last week, on the anima and animus at Ghost Ranch, again, tracing Jung's whole development of the animus, has something very interesting to say about another function of the animus. And she said, originally, it was seen as compensating for a feminine persona. Now, if you think of what that means, and one of you before we started tonight came up and said, what were some more books that they could read? And I have a few to suggest to you before you go tonight. That she had gotten Emma Jung's book on animus. But she said, you know, she was writing about women in the 1920s, 1930s. So animus compensating for that kind of a feminine persona. What would that mean? Why would we? Well, it would simply mean that all of those feminine characteristics that needed a balance would have that in the animus, right? So it was compensatory for that. Later, though, she says, it is felt to complement or supplement a feminine consciousness. Now, there's a difference between feminine persona and feminine consciousness, isn't there? We've already moved out of what society says we should be. And we've moved down into, or wherever it is that we can locate this, into what a woman's consciousness is about. Or if we're speaking of man, what a man's consciousness is about. And she says this is much broader conception. One which furthers the notion of a natural kind of femininity, which must be compensated by an archetypal masculinity. Now, let me go over that again for you. If the animus is supposed to complement or supplement this natural feminine consciousness, whatever it is that woman is naturally, kind of one-sided and all of these, whatever it is that woman has been defined by for a long time, then that has to be offset by something that's very, very powerful, very, very deep. And the animus was an archetype. So you're offsetting this consciousness of woman by an archetype, which really then all of a sudden changes the whole picture, doesn't it? As a princess, I see a couple yawns. And is it too hot in here? Is it stuffy? Yeah, I think so. Would you mind opening the window, Kate? Please. This stuff is okay. And she says clearly that the feminine persona was tailored to a specific social milieu, while feminine nature is not. And just as clearly, an animus which compensates a feminine persona may indeed be very, very broad across time and culture, whatever it is that takes to compensate that feminine persona. But the masculine as an archetype, a masculine principle, is not open to all of those variations that can be given to it by culture. And so she says, this really ups the ante. And we're kind of balancing off this natural feminine consciousness with something that's archetypal. And we know that the archetypes, they lead us into the realm of the gods. And so, consequently, the masculine was so often spiritual. We never heard, and we still don't. And yet I read you last week, the concept of the animus is changing. It was always the spiritual animus, the guide, the judge, and so on. Women have begun to dream of earth men and the other side of the masculine. Now, if this is so, then where is the archetype of the feminine in the feminine? And I'm going to get to the men, so hang in here. If the animus represents those archetypal levels of the masculine, where are the archetypal levels of the feminine in woman? You know, it's very interesting. It's only recently that we've begun to really hear about the goddess. And Jean Boland's book gets into this using the Greek imagery of the facets of woman that really are archetypal in their levels. Another one that I think does an even better job of this, it tracks along with the same Greek goddesses, is the one by Roger Woolger and his wife, and I don't know the exact title of it. It really explores this archetypal feminine principle in terms of the goddess. And so if we begin to relate animus in terms of gods within the feminine, then there must, or within the woman, then there must be the counterbalance of the archetypal feminine. And I think on some very deep level in our culture, we're hearing of the return of the goddess. Now, I'm going to skip over to what I was going to do in another section, but I think it really fits here. The same thing is happening in men's work. Many of you are familiar with the work of Robert Bly, Michael Mead, Robert Moore. And Moore particularly is exploring some of the archetypes of the male principle, and he's worked with at least four quite a bit, the king, the warrior, the lover, and the magician. Now, just suppose that every little boy grew up knowing there was a king in him. What would he know? He'd know something about his identity, about his authority, about his way with people. And a king usually implies a queen. It's that way in the fairy tales. It's that way in real life, because there must be a child to continue the lineage. So already we have the awareness of the syzygy, the wonderful feminine that is within him. Or suppose that he knew that there was a warrior in him. How much easier to leave his mother without all of that psychological hurt. There would be some, and he would have to leave home. But I don't think there would have to be such bitterness, such fierceness. That's not the warrior. He doesn't fight women. He fights battles. And he slays the mythological dragon. Somehow, if little boys grew up knowing these things, suppose that he knew that the lover was in him. Not sexual power that he finds out when he's in junior high, but the lover. All that implies. Already there has to be something to love. Maybe it starts with the earth. There's women to love. There are children. There are men to love. And here, as I was writing this, I didn't think particularly of sexual preference. But if we pursue this, I think that Jung has an interesting comment. Oh, he doesn't write a lot on homosexuality, but there's several places when he's talking about several of his clients, and he's talking about a young man, and he talks about his ego being identified with the anima, and this being expressed in homosexual behavior. Well, this is interesting. The feminine is in there. And what is the ego's relation to it? And I think this depends on how that ego is related to the relationship between the masculine and the feminine within oneself, and also what its relationship is with one of those halves. And this again, you know, we can't make any statements that are the absolute truth, and that's it. We have to keep thinking of exceptions. We have to keep expanding it. To back up this statement that Jung made, I've worked with several men who said, I was entirely too close to my mother. I bonded with them. I don't need that. I need to bond with the male. I need to know what the masculine is. And so their sexual preference was a male. I've heard those exact words almost from women. I know what the masculine is. My father and I were just like that. I need to know what the feminine is. And so their sexual preference was a life with a woman. On the other hand, if we think of what it is, the forces that shape us, remember now where we get input for.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.